York. This is Democracy Now!
Our primary focus today is how President Trump has fulfilled one of his central campaign promises to the American people in record time, ending the massive illegal invasion and securing our nation's southern and northern borders.
Today marks President Trump's first 100 days back in the White House. His approval rating is the lowest of any president at this stage in at least 70 years. On the eve of his 100th day, Trump signed a new executive order targeting sanctuary cities. Immigrant rights and labor groups are mobilizing for major protests Thursday to mark May Day. We'll speak to organizers in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. And then, as Palestinian officials accuse Israel of using aid as a weapon of war in Gaza, we'll speak with the Palestinian-American writer Sara Aziza, author of the new book, The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders.
I began the book in 2020, but I was finishing the second half of it in 2023. So it really became a challenge to hold both all that there is to love and defend about Palestine and specifically Gaza, where my family comes from, as well as trying to witness the horror and speak out against it and sort of drive the book towards both a defense of everything that we have left to gain and a negotiation with the despair that's always pressing in and always trying to challenge the hope and resilience that Palestinians have.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli airstrikes across the Gaza Strip have killed at least 13 Palestinians today, one day after Israeli attacks killed 48 others, including five children killed on a Gaza City street in an Israeli drone strike. Separately, four Palestinians were killed, three of them children, when Israel bombed a tent camp for displaced people near Khan Yunis. It's the latest attack by Israel on an area its military had designated as a so-called safe zone. Israel's unrelenting assault continued as Palestinian officials say Israel's total siege of Gaza has led to over 65,000 cases of acute malnutrition in children. This is Khan Yunis resident Basma Sheikh Khalil.
We call on the International Court of Justice to help in opening the crossings because the people are starving. This is a starvation policy. There is no flour and no food. There is nothing coming into the Gaza Strip. The people, both young and old, are sick. They can't find food or water to drink.
The International Court of Justice is holding a second day of hearings into Israel's obligations to provide humanitarian aid into Gaza. Earlier today, South Africa's representative told a panel of judges, quote, under the world's watchful eye, Palestinians are being subjected to atrocity, crimes, persecution, apartheid, and genocide, unquote. Throughout the week, representatives of 38 countries are set to address the court. Only two of those nations, the U.S. and Hungary, will testify in support of Israel's siege of Gaza. On Monday, Israel's foreign minister, Gideon Sa'ar, rejected the proceedings as part of a systematic persecution of Israel.
Israel decided not to take part in this circus. The U.N. has become a rotten, anti-Israel and anti-Semitic body.
Meanwhile, Amnesty International's accused Israel of carrying out a live-stream genocide in Gaza with the support of both major political parties in the United States. That's part of an assessment in Amnesty's annual State of the World's Human Rights Report, which is out today. In it, Amnesty's Secretary General Agnes Callamard writes, quote, 2024 will be remembered for how Israel's military occupation grew ever more brazen and deadly for the way the USA, Germany, and a handful of other European states supported Israel. The way the USA, under the Biden administration, repeatedly vetoed UN Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire and states' continued arms transfers to Israel, unquote. The UN's warning ongoing U.S. attacks on Yemen pose a deadly risk to civilians after a U.S. strike on a migrant detention center in the north of the country killed at least 68 people Monday and injured dozens more. Most or all the victims are believed to be migrants from African nations. This is Dawood Jibril from Ethiopia, a survivor of the attack.
We were sleeping in the prison when the aircraft struck. It bombed us, and then everyone was injured. Some were hit by debris, others had their legs amputated, and some were injured in their eyes and lost their sight. Many people died.
The U.S. has killed over 250 people in Yemen since escalating its attacks against Houthi forces in mid-March. A number of advocacy groups and progressive Democrats have demanded President Trump stop attacking Yemen and argued the strikes are unconstitutional as they've not been approved by Congress. In Canada, Mark Carney of the Liberal Party narrowly won snap elections and will remain in power as prime minister, defeating conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who also lost his own seat in parliament. Carney's victory comes amidst heightened tensions with the U.S. over Trump's tariffs and threats to annex Canada. Early Monday, Trump once again threatened to make Canada the 51st state. In his victory speech, Prime Minister Carney maintained the defiant tone that helped him surge in popularity in the weeks preceding the election, telling voters, quote, our old relationship with the United States is over.
America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
It's still unclear if liberals will secure enough votes to form a majority government, though they're projected to fall just shy of the 172 seats required. Meanwhile, the head of Canada's new Democratic Party, Jagmeet Singh, announced he's stepping down as party leader after the NDP was projected to lose over two-thirds of its seats, including his own. President Trump signed three more executive orders further cracking down on the rights of immigrants and asylum seekers. One order seeks to compile a list of so-called sanctuary cities that refuse to cooperate with Trump's mass deportation policies. A second order further militarizes local police departments while providing legal resources to officers accused of abuses. It also seeks to undo federal consent decrees for departments that have committed civil rights abuses and seeks to punish local officials who, quote, unlawfully prohibit law enforcement officers from carrying out duties, unquote. A third executive order requires professional truck drivers to be proficient in English. On Monday, staffers placed signs on the White House lawn showing mugshots of immigrants, linking them to crimes with the word arrested written in all caps. This comes as House Republicans have proposed a bill that would charge people arriving at a U.S. port of entry $1,000 in order to file an asylum claim and a $3,500 fee for those sponsoring children. The right to seek asylum is a fundamental human right enshrined in international law, and the U.S. has never before charged petitioners. A U.S. lawyer representing 10 Venezuelan men deported without due process to El Salvador by the Trump administration says she was denied access to her clients at the notorious Sicat prison. Carrie Kennedy said from San Salvador on Monday, she'd also hoped to document human rights abuses inside the prison.
The president of the United States has done so following the same script that President Bukele has used against his own people, the label of terrorists, the gang members, without any shred of evidence and any semblance of due process.
Carrie Kennedy is a sister of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the daughter of the assassinated former Attorney General and presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. The Trump administration's dismissed some 400 researchers involved in putting together the National Climate Assessment. The flagship governmental report is designed to help local and federal authorities respond to the evolving climate crisis and is published every few years by congressional mandate. The sixth edition of the assessment was scheduled to be released in 2028, though its publication is now in question. In related news, federal cuts ordered by Elon Musk's Doge operation have canceled AmeriCorps' National Civilian Community Corps, which places over 2,000 young people in community nonprofits or in disaster recovery roles. Over two-thirds of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division staff are expected to leave their jobs, accepting a resignation offer as the Trump administration moves to drastically reshape the agency. The new director of the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, Harmeet K. Dhillon, has ordered workers to turn their attention to combating anti-Semitism, anti-Christian bias, and so-called woke ideology. As part of the division's overhaul, senior positions overseeing the Justice Department's work on voting rights have been removed, and attorneys have been directed to dismiss all active cases. As President Trump marks 100 days back in office, new polls show his approval rating around 40%, the lowest rating for the first 100 days of any president in 80 years. A Washington Post-ABC News poll found even fewer people trust the Democratic Party, with nearly 7 in 10 saying it's out of touch, while 6 in 10 say Trump is out of touch. As the so-called Department of Government Efficiency also marks 100 days of gutting the federal government, a new Senate report finds Elon Musk and his businesses could avoid over $2 billion in potential legal liability thanks to cuts Musk enacted as head of DOGE. When Trump was inaugurated, Musk was facing up to 65 actions from 11 federal agencies targeting SpaceX, Tesla, Neuralink, the Boeing Company, and XAI. That's the Boring Company. Senate Democrats now say Musk has largely averted those actions thanks to DOGE helping him, quote, evade oversight, derail investigations, and make litigation disappear whenever he so chooses on his terms and at his command, unquote. President Trump's pardon, Paul Wolchek, a Florida healthcare executive convicted of tax evasion for stealing nearly $11 million in payroll taxes from the paychecks of doctors and nurses. Just 12 days ago, a jury found him guilty after prosecutors showed he used the money to finance a lavish lifestyle that included luxury goods and a $2 million yacht. He is the son of Betsy Fago, a healthcare entrepreneur and Republican Party donor. Meanwhile, President Trump has pardoned a Republican former Las Vegas City Councilwoman and state lawmaker from Nevada who was convicted in October of embezzling funds. Michelle Fiore was found guilty of 6 counts of federal wire fraud and 1 count of conspiracy for raising over $70,000 for the statue of a slain Las Vegas police officer and instead using the money to pay for rent, plastic surgery, and her daughter's wedding. Democratic leaders led a 12-hour sit-in protest on the Capitol steps as lawmakers returned to Washington, D.C. to take up a budget for the 2026 fiscal year. The New York Times reports the White House is proposing a budget that would cut billions of dollars from programs that support child care, health research, education, housing assistance, community development, and the elderly. Meanwhile, 3 civil rights leaders were arrested Monday as they held prayers inside the Capitol Rotunda to protest against the Republican-led budget bill. Among the arrested was Reverend William J. Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign.
How many of you believe, even more than you did when you came here, that this budget is a moral issue? Yes. And that this current budget is, say this with me if you believe it, it is morally indefensible. It's constitutionally inconsistent. And it's economically insane.
Electricity has been restored to most of Spain and Portugal after a massive power failure unexpectedly struck the Iberian Peninsula Monday. The widespread blackout stranded rail and airline passengers, shuttered schools, businesses and offices, and forced hospitals to operate on emergency generators. Spanish and Portuguese authorities say they're still determining the cause of one of the biggest power outages ever seen in Europe. And the Vatican says it'll begin the process of selecting a new pope May 7th. Some 135 cardinals, all of them men under the age of 80, will begin a closed-door meeting on that date to vote for the new leader of the 1.4 billion member Catholic Church. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As President Trump marks 100 days back in the White House, immigrant rights and labor groups are mobilizing for major May Day protests on Thursday. We'll go to Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. Stay with us.
Today I feel weak, but tomorrow I'll feel a queen. I was raised by the street. Do you know what that really means? All this hurt I've suffered, it just begins again in a baby girl or a full-grown man. Tomorrow will come like the turning of the sun over tall buildings and the beating of a drum. It lives in my heart, but buried in the past. Here comes the navigator. She knows you're fading.
The Navigator by Alinda Segarra of Hooray for the Riffraff in our Democracy Now! Studio back in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Today marks 100 days since President Trump returned to the White House. Multiple polls show his approval rating after 100 days is lower than any president in 80 years. Ahead of his 100th day, Trump signed three new executive orders, including one targeting sanctuary cities. The order instructs Attorney General Pam Bondi to pursue, quote, all necessary legal remedies and enforcement measures, unquote, against state and local jurisdictions who refuse to assist with Trump's mass deportation plans. A second order further militarizes local police departments and seeks to punish local officials who, quote, unlawfully prohibit law enforcement officers from carrying out duties, unquote. It also provides legal resources to officers accused of abuses. A third executive order requires professional truck drivers to be proficient in English. This comes as outrage grows over Trump's sweeping anti-immigrant crackdown. On Friday, the Trump administration deported to Honduras three U.S. citizen children, including a four-year-old boy who's actively receiving treatment for a rare form of stage four cancer. The boy was removed with his seven-year-old sister, who's also a U.S. citizen, and their mother. In a separate case, the U.S. removed a two-year-old U.S. citizen, along with her mother. The Trump administration also continues to refuse court orders to bring home Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father who was mistakenly flown to El Salvador by the Department of Justice's own admission on March 15th. Over the weekend, ICE conducted a number of high-profile immigration raids in Florida. ICE worked with local officials to detain nearly 800 people. Meanwhile, in Colorado Springs, ICE agents raided a nightclub and made over 100 arrests. Immigrant rights groups across the country are planning major May Day protests for Thursday. We begin today's show with two guests helping to plan the May Day protests. Here in New York, Nisha Tabassum, the lead organizer for worker issues at Make the Road New York, an immigrant rights and advocacy group. And in Chicago, we're joined by Jorge Mujica, the strategic organizer for Arise Chicago, which advocates for immigrant workers' rights, one of the lead organizers of the May Day protests in Chicago. Jorge, before we talk about those major protests on Thursday, can you go to these executive orders and respond to what President Trump did very significantly on this eve of the 100th day he's back in office? And interestingly, as his polls across the board are tanking, including how he's dealing with immigrants.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having us here. These are smoke screens. President Trump has signed 157, I think, executive orders related to immigration. It is not possible to even comply, start complying with the legal ones. Forget about challenging the illegal ones. It's just a continuous circus. He will be issuing orders and more orders, even if they don't make any kind of sense. The federal government cannot mandate a local police department to do anything or to not do anything. The city of Chicago is a municipality completely free to decide what exactly their police does. So I don't think we have to pay a whole lot more attention to this kind of crazy executive orders.
And Jorge, could you talk about the protests that are planned not only for May Day, but for the following days? Chicago, back in 2006, you were part of the organizers of the first immigrant rights protest. And it was really Chicago that set the whole nation off on a series of protests that stunned the country back then.
That's right. And I think we took the lead again. Back in January, we started meeting. Because there were several calls by several people, mostly social media personalities, saying that we should have a day without immigrants here and there. And we decided that we should concentrate in one particular day, one particular date, to really be able to get everybody together. The Trump administration miscalculated completely. Instead of attacking only one community, as they did in 2006, they are attacking everybody at the same time. And that enabled us to gather a really broad coalition with labor unions, with federal workers, with students, with teachers at universities, and every other community, and put together this event on May Day. May Day was born in Chicago. And we recovered May Day for history because it had been completely forgotten. Everybody thought it was a foreign celebration. But it's May Day, Chicago. This is the origin of May Day. So we decided to march on this day and to have several actions on the following days. On Friday, May 2nd, students are going to walk out their colleges and universities and high schools. And we are promoting a no margaritas and no guacamole weekend. You know, we cannot have a society celebrating a Cinco de Mayo without Mexicans. If they want their Cinco de Mayo, they have to want Mexicans in this town and this city. So we are putting together this series of events over the weekend, starting on May Day, Thursday.
And Nisha Tabassum, could you talk about what is being planned for New York City?
Yeah, thank you so much, Jorge. You know, we're living in a moment where we're seeing unprecedented attacks on unions and workers in this country. We're seeing corporate takeovers of our federal government. We're seeing companies and billionaires exploiting workers for their own gain. And so right now we are joining, Make the Road is joining over 50 unions and advocacy groups and immigrant rights groups to come together on May 1st at 5 p.m. at Foley Square. To demand that we need to stand back and fight. We need to fight this corporate takeover. We are the many. They are the few. It's time to stand back and fight. So really encouraging everyone to come join us, come march with us. As you've already stated, you know, Labor May Day is rooted in resistance. And this is a moment that we all need to come together to fight against these federal cuts, to fight against the attacks on all different kinds of workers, especially immigrant workers.
And Jorge, I wanted to go back to you for a second. You've also talked about Arise Chicago is also targeting certain corporations for consumer boycotts. Could you talk about that as well?
That's correct. We, the Consejo de Resistencia y Defensa del Inmigrante, that's the right denomination. We are targeting three major stores. We are targeting Walmart, we are targeting Target and McDonald's, mostly because of their complying with Donald Trump orders to do away with minority hiring and, you know, affirmative actions. And also two particular brands, very popular in the Mexican community and the Latino community, and those are Goya products and Miller Beer, because they are sponsors of the Republican Party, because they donated money to Donald Trump. So we decided to go ahead and stop buying these products, and we will be promoting that boycott over the May Day weekend, too.
We're also joined by Georgia Flowers Lee, National Education Association Vice President for United Teachers Los Angeles, has been an educator for over 20 years. As we mark this 100th day of President Trump's term, he has signed I don't know how many executive orders, both around immigration, most recently on the eve of this day yesterday, and also around DEI, around diversity, equity and inclusion. If you can talk about why you're going to be out in the streets on Thursday and what your gravest concerns are right now. Interestingly, overall, with these polls tanking, you may be well representing the majority of people in this country, Georgia.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. Yeah, we're going to be out in the streets on May Day, along with a broad coalition of other labor unions, of advocacy groups, of immigrant rights groups, because the attacks that are coming are targeting our children, targeting our immigrant families. It really, it seems as if it's a move to destroy the foundation on which our democracy is built. All the cuts that are coming out of the Department of Education, what that is going to do to our students, particularly our students who are most marginalized, or students with exceptional needs, or students who begin life with challenges. What happens to those students? And we are keeping our eye on the move to privatize public education, which we all acknowledge is the foundation of democracy. It's what gives us an opportunity. Without public education, kids who start off behind the ball are simply not going to have a chance. So we feel it is our absolute moral obligation to stand up to fight for our students and for our families, particularly our immigrant families and or students who are terrified. We had just a couple of weeks ago, the Department of Homeland Security tried to invade two of our elementary schools and take students out. Luckily, the staff at that school, at those schools, were able to defend and prevent it from happening. But imagine how terrifying that is for our students and for the families who entrust their students, who entrust their children to our care. So we see this as a moral imperative for us to stand up, to stand in coalition with others, and to push back against what is happening. And so we'll be out there on May Day, but we will also be out there on May 17th. We are mobilizing with other teachers' unions across the metropolitan LA area to show up. And we are showing up at SpaceX, and we are letting the folks who are controlling the levers of power know that we are taking our power back. We are not ceding anything, and we think it is absolutely our moral obligation to do so.
And Georgia Flowers Lee, could you talk about the response of the public school districts in California to the The recent announcement, the Department of Education, that all school districts have to certify that they're not involved with any kind of what the government calls discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, or they'll face cutoffs of Title I money?
Across the board, we are saying no. The California Department of Education has said no. Or state affiliate, the California Teachers Association, has said no. Diversity is our strength. We want inclusion. Inclusion means we all get an opportunity. We all get to be involved. We all get to participate. And equity simply means that, you know, that we are trying to level the playing field. So we are absolutely saying no to it. My district, the LA Unified School District, I believe has already responded and said, this is not something that we are going to comply with. And so across the board, we are saying this is not acceptable to us, and we are not complying with it because we see it for what it is.
Nisha, I wanted to go to an issue here in New York. Last week, a judge temporarily halted efforts by Mayor Eric Adams to reopen an ICE office inside the Rikers Island jail complex. Adams first signaled the move after he met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, in February. At the time, the New York Civil Liberties Union slammed Adams' administration for selling out New Yorkers for Trump's dangerous deportation regime. The group said in a statement, quote, ICE's presence on Rikers serves no legitimate purpose, opens the door to unlawful collusion between local law enforcement and federal immigration officials in violation of our city's well-established sanctuary protections. New Yorkers see this for what it is, Mayor Adams skirting the city council, cozying up to Trump, and putting New Yorkers, immigrant New Yorkers, in harm's way, the group said. And we all know about the Trump administration dropping the charges against Mayor Eric Adams, which many people called a quid pro quo for him then doing their bidding around immigration. If you can respond to what Eric Adams is pushing for, what the judge has stopped.
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, luckily we live in a city that has a really strong city council that has passed really strong immigrant protections in New York City. The city council has a suit to stop the Adams administration executive order from allowing ICE on Rikers, and there is a temporary restraining order. And I think this shows us that, like, we really need our state leadership to take strong action to protect immigrant communities and workers and families in New York. You know, Make the Road New York, along with labor unions and other immigrant groups, are pushing for New York for All, which is a law that would prevent cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. No one should have their rights be different based on where they live, right? The goal of New York for All is to standardize these strong immigrant protections across the state, not just in New York City. We have county executives in Nassau, Long Island, you know, collaborating with the federal government willingly to have detectives cooperating with ICE. And this would prevent that, right? This is the time where we actually really need our state leaders to step up and incorporate protections and standardize protections across the board, not just in New York City. Your rights should not be different based on where you live.
And Jorge Mujica, I'm wondering if you could talk about where people are gathering in Chicago on May Day and what the plans are for the protest that day.
Yeah, we are gathering at 11 a.m. at Union Park, the corner of Lake and Ashland Avenues. And we're going to be marching across downtown all the way pretty much to Lake Michigan. We're going to cross the whole downtown. We will be arriving at Grand Park around maybe 2 to 2:30 p.m. And we will have a program continues for until 4 p.m. or so. We have over 180 labor unions and community organizations, and everybody wants to speak because, again, since everybody's under attack, everybody has a say on this. So everybody wants to speak. It's going to be a long program, the whole day going on, and we hope everybody comes over. We are expecting about 500,000 people there.
And I wanted to ask Jorge Mojica about ICE entering the schools in Chicago and the response overall of the community.
Oh, they have tried. The Secret Service back in January tried to detain or interrogate at least an 11-year-old kid at a school. And that prompted a strong response from the city of Chicago. We have now in place a full policy on who's responsible for, impeding entry to ICE agencies or FBI or Secret Service if they don't follow due procedure, due process. Nobody can enter a school at any time. They are designated persons to talk to the kids about it. The city put a whole plan together for the safety of the kids.
And what about, Nisha, here in New York, this executive order that was signed yesterday, the targeting of sanctuary cities? Yeah. What does that mean for New York City?
It means that New York City really needs to stand steadfast in its protections of years of advocacy, passing laws that protect immigrants coming into New York. They make up the fabric of everyday life. Immigrant New Yorkers, you know, their labor powers our cities and they make our cities vibrant. Studies have shown sanctuary city laws actually make our communities safer. It fosters actually more trust between immigrants and law enforcement to come forward and report crime. So we're really like urging cities and states to remain steadfast in their protections and not, give in to these threats from the Trump administration.
And finally, Georgia Flowers, what are the plans for the rallies and the marches on May Day in Los Angeles for those people from that area who may want to participate?
So we are meeting at 9 a.m. in the intersection of Figueroa Street and Olympic Boulevard, gathering together with hopefully 100,000 of our friends and neighbors, and we are marching through downtown to City Hall. So we're looking for folks to come out and join us, and there's every indication that it's going to be massive.
And before you go, Georgia Flowers Lee in Los Angeles, as an educator and a person who's particularly concerned with children on the autism spectrum, how have Trump's budget cuts impacted kids, particularly in your schools?
So we are watching what the effect of these proposed cuts could be. So our students are entitled, or students with special needs, particularly on the autism spectrum, are entitled to supports that allow them to thrive, to show up as their best selves in our classrooms. And so we are pushing to make sure that those supports remain. However, whatever the federal government cuts has to be made up for at the local level. And so our district, our state, will have to absorb those costs, which means that, there will be less to fund all our students if the federal government is not providing what it should to help support our neediest students. So we are pushing our district to make sure that they continue to get whatever they can. And we are really impressing on our state legislature to continue to provide for our students, to make sure that our students have access and that they have the resources that they need.
Georgia Flowers Lee, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President for United Teachers Los Angeles, Jorge Mojica of Arise Chicago, and Nisha Tabassum of Make the Road New York, all involved with organizing Métis protests beginning on Thursday. On this 100th day, this conversation taking place of President Trump back in office. Coming up, we speak with Palestinian-American writer Sada Aziza, author of the new book, The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. Stay with us. Mm-hmm.
And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breeze. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute. How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall. It's the gift, I guess I'll pass it on. Mother thinks it'll lift the stress of Babylon. Mother knows, my mother, she suffered blows. I don't know how we survived such violent episodes. I was so worried, it hurt to see you bleed. But as soon as you came out the hospital, you gave me sweets, yeah. They tried to take you from me, but you still only gave them some prayers and sympathy. Dear mama, you helped me write this by showing me to give is priceless. And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breathe. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute. All I can say is the worst is over now. We can serve the hard times.
Take a Minute by the Somali-Canadian musician Kanan, performing in our Democracy Now! Studios back in 2009. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The International Court of Justice is holding a week-long hearing on Israel's obligations to provide aid to Gaza. On Monday, Palestinian envoy Amr Hijazi accused Israel of using humanitarian aid as weapons of war as Israel continues its devastating blockade.
That's really the heart of why Palestine and over 40 other states are addressing the court today. It is not about the number of aid trucks Israel is or is not allowing into the occupied Palestinian territory, especially Gaza. It is not about Israel destroying the it is about Israel destroying the fundamentals of life in Palestine while it blocks UN and other humanitarians from providing life-saving aid to the population. It is about Israel unraveling fundamental principles of international law, including their obligations under the UN Charter. It is about Israel turning Palestine, in particularly Gaza, into a mass grave for Palestinians and those coming to their aid.
We end today's show with a new memoir by the award-winning Palestinian-American journalist and author, Sara Aziza. She was born in the United States as a daughter and granddaughter of Palestinian refugees from Gaza. Her new book is called The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. In it, she examines her recovery from anorexia that she nearly died from in 2019 as part of the generational trauma experienced as part of her Palestinian family's history of exile. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. The Paris Review just published an excerpt of your new book, The Hollow Half. Congratulations on its publication. You have this quote, "You were dead, Sara. You were dead." In October 2019, you entered the hospital. You were suffering from anorexia. Many believed it could be fatal for you. And that is not only so real in your body, but it has also become a metaphor for what you describe, your family, the post-traumatic stress disorder from what's happening in Gaza. Can you lay out what happened to you and how you broaden that to your family and people's experience?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's an honor for me to be here. Thank you for your work. So the story does start with my body sort of being shattered and nearly erased by this mental health issue that I was dealing with that I thought, you know, according to the medical Western model, I accepted the diagnosis that this was an individual disease, something I needed to wrestle with and recover. But as I sort of trace in the book, even beginning in the hospital, I began to recover memories of my Palestinian grandmother that led to a curiosity, a deeper curiosity about my family's history in Gaza and Palestine, the greater Nakba. And as a daughter of the diaspora, I hadn't tied my own story so viscerally to the story of my people. Of course, I knew it, but sort of the understanding that many people in the diaspora have is we've crossed this threshold, this border, right? Whether it's a temporal border or a geographical border of we're the safe ones. We made it out and, you know, we pray for Gaza. We maybe organize for Gaza, but somehow we're a little bit more protected here in the United States. But what this book really examines is both the incredible inspiration that I directly draw from my grandmother, who is an illiterate, disabled, small woman who survived the Nakba, the 1967 war, was displaced from Gaza. You know, sort of the kind of woman that's not held up to us in the United States or even, you know, maybe in broader culture as a hero and as a model. I was following the model of the American dream, the meritocracy. I was believed that if I could advance myself, you know, I could make my Baba proud, I could make my grandmother proud, but I didn't need to tie my own story so directly to her. But what I realized was that her suffering and her loss, but also her resilience, carried some of the keys that I needed to recover from my individual malady and sort of reorient my life with Gaza and Palestine at its center, rather than falling for, I guess, the line of the American dream, which ends up being hollow and betraying most all of us, as your guests today, you know, sort of laid out in some very real present ways.
And Sarah, could you talk about the title, The Hollow Half? Mm-hmm.
Of course, yeah. I mean, as I was just, you know, sort of alluding to, the hollowness is, there's many dimensions to it, I think. One of them is the hollowness of the hunger, right, and the anorexia that the book begins with. But it's also the hollowness of the American dream, and it's also the hollowness of this idea of halfness, this idea of being half American, half Palestinian. By the end of the book, I'm sort of rejecting that. I'm sort of coming to understand that Palestinianness is a whole identity, and it speaks to every part of my life, whether I'm in the diaspora or outside of it. It kind of unfolds the further the book goes along.
And as someone who works with translation from Arabic into English, you write about the Arabic word zikr for memory. Can you talk about how memory in Arabic is a living thing?
I love that question. Yeah, the fourth chapter is named after this Arabic word zikr, which means both to remember and to invoke. So the book begins with memory. It begins with recovering from the archive and the family archive all that was sort of lost or left behind as my family moved from their ancestral home, which was destroyed and ethnically cleansed in 1948, into Gaza, and then after the 67 war, out of Gaza, into Syria, Jordan, and eventually Saudi Arabia. So this is a form of memory, right? Recovering from history, what was erased or written over or discarded by the powers that be. But dhikr also means to invoke. So it was sort of an answering of a calling back to Palestine, realizing that Palestine really invokes the value system that I want to adopt as a Palestinian, but also anyone who seeks to defy empire and search for a different future for all of us. I think we're seeing every day how pressing and urgent the need for a different future is. So it's an invocation as well as a remembering.
Sona, can you talk about how you've kept in touch with your family in Gaza now, sharing their messages with the world? Talk about people like your cousin, Nabil, and how you've been translating his writing and his poetry.
Thank you for bringing my family into this conversation. Yeah, the book was, I started writing it in 2020, but I was still finishing it in 2023 when the genocide escalated. You know, we could say the genocide's been going on for decades, but So yeah, we have a lot of family in Gaza. My family's lost in the greater, like, you know, extended family, over 200 people. But there's a
Where do they live?
They were in Nusrat refugee camp, Deir al-Balah, some of them in Khan Yunus, also in Jabalia. So all over. Of course, it's been unspeakably heartbreaking and horrific, and a deep challenge to find words. Actually, the dedication of this book is "For Gaza, words fail." So I wrote this book, but I also recognize the limits of language. But as you beautifully brought to our attention, I did translate some of my cousin Nabil's poetry. He's been sending these missives, you know, to me and my parents quite frequently from Gaza. And you know, he's a pharmacist actually, but lost his job, of course, in all the destruction. But it turns out he's a poet as well. The ways that it speaks of his despair some days, his hope other days, his pain, his hunger most recently in this, you know, increasingly intense famine that he's facing. It was a gift to be able to publish some of his words. I hope to do more. As a Palestinian in the diaspora, I mean, I'm honored to have a book out. My cousin Nabil even messaged me saying they were proud, they feel remembered. But I think it's always so important to point back to the voices in Gaza. So I hope to do more of that. You know, as my career goes on, I want to elevate and translate and bring Palestinian voices from inside the land to the broader community. Yeah.
Could you talk as well about your cousin Hanin, who was 26 years old and set to graduate from college a few months after October 7th, 2023?
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah. Hanin is Nabil's sister. She's also just this incredibly precious soul. She's continuing, you know, to send us messages as well. But yeah, she was getting ready to graduate from college, you know, having survived so many wars and still being able to continue her education, then higher education. When the war started and they were displaced for the first time, she brought her graduation gown and cap with her, you know, as they fled from one place to another. And I think that just speaks to this duality that Palestinians, particularly in Gaza and you know, the greater historic Palestine, have to hold constantly. It's the same, you know, hope that drove my father to, you know, continue to overcome one obstacle after another, as I trace in the book. So Hanin is just such an inspiration to me. She has continued to educate her younger brothers, you know, sort of like homeschool them throughout these displacements. And, you know, I spoke to her on the phone somewhat recently, not as recently as I would have liked, as it's difficult. But, you know, she still has high spirits most days. I know it's I don't want to sugarcoat it. Resilience is a complicated thing and it has its limits. But I would love to be half the woman that she is someday. Mm.
Sara, you write in your book about your father and grandmother's return to Gaza, mm-hmm. to the smell mm-hmm. of the sea, mm-hmm. to the moment of joy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about their experiences yeah. and how you experience Gaza here? You were actually born here.
Yeah. Thank you. That's one of my favorite parts of the book, getting to reconstruct this moment. My father was born in Deir al-Balah, Gaza, and then in 67, when he was 7 years old, they were displaced to Saudi Arabia. But then as a teenager, he and his mother went back to visit Khan Yunus and Deir al-Balah. And, you know, just this moment he describes of, you know, he was living in Saudi Arabia, so around other Arabs, speaking Arabic. But when he crossed over and began hearing the Ghazan dialect and smelling the sea, you know, his body remembered the sea, maybe in ways he didn't even know he was carrying. So, you know, he just describes this feeling of aliveness, this familial sense of, I'm with my people again. He said, I wanted to run to each one and take their hand and tell them, I'm one of you, we're family. And from there, you know, he discovers as a young man Palestine all over again, because this is a diaspora experience of trying to get as close to our land and our history as we can, with one set of obstacles after another. And each year and each decade, it gets harder. But yeah, so I also got to revisit Palestine several times using the privilege of my American passport. I spent a few months in Nablus, and then my brother, father, and I were able to find the traces of our family village, which was destroyed in 1948. It's in rubble. The cemetery was razed by either a bulldozer or a tank, but there's still traces. And I think Palestinians everywhere are finding whatever way they can to continue to connect to that history and to bring that history into the present and to use that history to inform our hope for the future.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you could talk some about the emotional change that you've gone through as you see now the Israeli war, the massacres in Gaza continuing, and the rest of the world refusing to do anything substantive about Israel, and also being here in the United States where anyone who protests this genocide is immediately criminalized and persecuted, whether it's by universities or the government or even sometimes the media.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, again, this is one of the reasons I appreciate this programming, is it's a place where I've seen courageous reporting and elevating of Palestinian voices when I'm not seeing a fraction of what we need to see. So thank you again. It's been horrific. It's been, it feels like a privilege to even talk about how horrible it's been for me, because I know nothing compares to what the Palestinians in Palestine and specifically Gaza are going through. But it's propelled me to dedicate myself ever more to these stories, to preserving and defending all the beauty and the abundance that is Palestine. You know, we are more than a genocide. We are more than Nakba. So it's again that duality of, in this book, there are many moments of joy and lushness and abundance, but also these moments of horror and heartbreak. And, you know, that's really just, you know, a small example of the larger scale of the Palestinian experience that you speak to. I think the last almost 2 years now has been this strange sense of deja vu, but on a scale, you know, none of us ever wanted to imagine. There's this sense of the externalization of history, like this thing that I knew in my body and carried in my body and my DNA, you know, of there is a force that's trying to erase us from the earth. There's a force that wants to silence our stories, that wants to silence anyone who would speak out, you know, in solidarity with us. It's been a very lonely and isolated sort of experience being a Palestinian in the U.S. Again, not to privilege my suffering, but I think the world is starting to see what Palestinians and those who have been paying attention have always known, which is Zionism is a relentless and totalizing project. It won't stop until we're erased and we're gone. And there is no amount of nuance. There's not a modicum of nuance to Zionism. And as the U.S., which is also a Zionist country, has doubled down on its Zionist policies and intentions, both under Biden and now under Trump, I think that the lines are just clearer than ever. I hope that people understand, if they didn't before, that Zionism, as well as just like the U.S. imperial project, is a project of anti-life. You know, there's no life for Palestinians, and there's no life for many of us as long as these projects are allowed to go on. So I commend the courage of the students and the journalists and the academics and the everyday people on the street who've been standing with us. And I just hope that we can continue to push forward, because any hope that Palestinians have, it begins first and foremost with the people on the ground resisting the absolute brute force of empire, which is coming to bear with everything it has on Gaza, but also here in the U.S., that we need to stay steadfast.
And what has it meant to you that so many of those, for example, have been arrested, mm-hmm. have been Jewish, that Jewish solidarity with Palestinians mm-hmm. Fighting what is taking place?
I mean, I think it just completely cuts out at the knees this argument that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. I think that, again, that's such a disingenuous argument. It always has been. You know, actually, the PLO charter in the 1960s that they issued, you know, sort of, this is the resistance group that was resisting Zionism. They said that anyone who is Jewish, who lived on the land, you know, originally, was considered Palestinian. You know, this is like, we've always been a pluralistic society, a multi-faith society. Again, this idea that's a religious war or an anti-Semitic project, absolutely false. Of course, there's been, you know, there's an ancient Jewish community on historic Palestine. This is, you know, not about the identity of those that are massacring us, but it is about the massacre itself. Massacres, genocide, ethnic cleansing, imperialism, these are wrong no matter who is perpetrating them. And we are ready to work, as you mentioned, hand in hand with anyone of any identity who wants to stand in solidarity. So we're grateful for those partners.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Sara Aziza, the Palestinian-American journalist and author. Her new book is just out. It's called The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for an individual giving manager to support our fundraising team. You can learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Sakwath Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.